This is the Inland Journal from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Doug Nadvornik.
Population growth across the United States and northern Idaho is driving demand for more building materials, energy, consumer goods, and agricultural products, which all move by rail.
This is from a video produced for Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway, BNSF, making a case for an expansion of its rail line in and around Sandpoint.
BNSF Railway meets up with Montana Rail Link at Sandpoint, Idaho. There, rail traffic from both railroads merge together to travel over Lake Pendere on a single-track bridge.
Burlington Northern wants to build three more bridges, including a second span over Pendere.
As you can imagine, much like a highway, delays can happen when you merge multiple lanes down to one lane. And if you have a two- or three-lane highway that merges to one lane shared by both directions of traffic, you will see backups on either side that can extend for many miles.
So the railroad argues Sandpoint is a train bottleneck that needs to be fixed.
It slows trains as they come to Sandpoint, but also has an impact all the way into Washington and Montana. By building a second mainline bridge over the lake, trains will move across the lake both directions at the same time, reducing the time trains must wait for other trains to cross the bridge.
That brings us to a public hearing Wednesday night at Sandpoint Middle School. It was sponsored by the Idaho Department of Lands, which is required to issue a so-called encroachment permit before BNSF could use fill materials at various places around the new bridges. The longest of the three spans would run parallel to the current tracks that traverse the lake, about 2 miles. Smaller bridges would also carry cars over Sand Creek and Bridge Street. The state says more than 1,100 people have filed written testimony during the last few months. Many of the pro-bridge comments came from people all over the country who sent in identically worded form letters. Some came from local Sandpoint residents. Some support the project. Others, such as Shannon Williamson from the Lake Pendere Waterkeeper, say they're withholding judgment and urge the federal and state governments to do a thorough study of the railroad's proposal.
Well, we're concerned about potential increases in transport of hazardous materials throughout the watershed. There was about 4 train derailments in North Idaho and Western Montana last year. Thankfully, none of them were containing hazardous materials, but the frequency at which they occurred really, you know, opened our eyes to the potential for this to happen either adjacent to or over our waterways, and so we're very concerned about that.
At Wednesday night's hearing, several people, such as Rebecca Holland, conveyed that same message. She asked the federal agencies that also must issue permits for this project to require that a full environmental impact statement be done to analyze it, as opposed to what's known as an environmental analysis, which critics argue is less stringent.
We do not know the projected number of increased trains that this project could bring across our lake or into our community. It is only prudent to operate with an understanding of risk versus reward in this situation that involves a good-sized population of people working here in a recreationally based economy here in Bonner County.
Supporters of the project argue a stricter environmental document isn't necessary. Pierre Bordenave is from Jacobs Engineering in Sandpoint, which has drawn up the plans for the new bridges. He says BNSF has worked hard to shrink the project's environmental footprint.
Originally, this was about 5 acres in the desire to figure out how to make this work. Working closely with the design engineers and BNSF, we were able to work that down to about 3 acres. Then as got a little more innovative and a little more creative, we were able to reduce this down to 1.54 acres. Construction plans and timing were developed to minimize traffic impacts and ensure continuous access. BNSF will work with City of Sandpoint on making sure that happens.
Bonner County Commissioners Glenn Bailey and Dan McDonald argued the economic benefits of the project should be seriously considered. McDonald says the region's economic vitality depends upon modernizing antiquated rail infrastructure.
The current system we have is falling behind. The bottleneck in Sandpoint, where 3 rail lines come together into a single track, has been a consistent problem for years now. Not only does it create a lineup of freight and passenger rail traffic, but it also causes delays on community roads and rail crossings. And as a commissioner When we do have those trains sitting on the tracks and they're blocking roadways, our phones start ringing.
Stop trains can delay people, but so can moving trains.
Matt Nikiel works for the Idaho Conservation League.
And if the bridge adds capacity to our rail infrastructure and allows more trains to be moving through our community, that's going to delay people too. And I think we need to analyze that and actually know, are there going to be benefits to us or not?
Wednesday was the final day that the Idaho Department of Lands was to accept public comments on this proposal. Its director is expected to announce within a month whether the agency will issue an encroachment permit. Two federal agencies, the Coast Guard and the Army Corps of Engineers, will lead their own public process this summer for the permits they've been asked to provide. One disclaimer, BNSF is an underwriter of Spokane Public Radio. Imagine using your smartphone to check in on how much energy your home or business are using. Avista says that will be possible within the next 2 years with its project to install new smart meters and sensors for all of its Washington customers. During a press event at Avista on Monday, Heather Rosentrader said customers often complain after receiving their monthly bills in the mail.
I've heard the frustrations about not understanding how their behavior impacts a bill that they receive 30 days after they've used that energy.
Rosentrader is Avista's vice president of energy delivery. The utility announced on Monday that it will begin replacing home and business electric meters that are often dozens of years old with new versions made by Liberty Lake-based Itron. It will also install new sensors on existing gas meters. Rosentrader says the new machinery will allow Avista to more closely track its customers' consumption habits.
And then that information will be available to customers to view on their secure account.
Josh DeLuciano, Avista's Director of Electrical Engineering, says customers will be able to see their electricity usage in 5-minute intervals and their gas consumption in hourly intervals.
Part of our plan is down the road is that customers will be able to get proactive alerts if they choose to. Avista will be able to notify them when their usage is trending outside of a normal value that they would expect.
DeLuciano says the new meters will also help Avista discover power outages faster and react more quickly to repair them. He says they would have been a big help during the region's destructive windstorm in 2015.
As that storm rolled out, we would have had insights to what was going on across the system, had been able to prioritize and allocate our crews as we needed. And then as we restored customers, we would have been able to use that information to verify what was been restored versus what was left out there.
Over the next 2 years, Avista estimates it will install about 450,000 new meters in Washington in two phases. The first phase will come this fall when the utility will swap out about 4,000 meters downtown around Spokane International Airport and at Clear Lake. It will monitor how the new system works and make tweaks before phase two, which is scheduled to start next spring in Spokane. Avista has already installed Itron smart meters in a small part of its Washington service area. Sherilyn Moore is Itron's Senior Vice President of Networked Solutions.
We employed very similar technology at a smaller scale in Pullman. Going back just a few years, the technology was installed. Avista was able to glean benefits in operational efficiency as well as improve the reliability of their electricity system there.
The meter conversion project is expected to take about 2 years and cost Avista $165 million. Utility officials hope to pay for it through future rate hikes. The company will apply for those with the Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission after the installation is finished. Avista officials say they will also consider smart meter projects for their customers in Idaho and Oregon. In Seattle, startup companies and entrepreneurship are viewed as old hat. University of Washington medical researchers, for example, have long worked to turn ideas into products and services. In Spokane, that entrepreneurial spirit is still in the development phase. While Spokane does have some venture capital, this is not yet a place known as a hotspot for angel investors. But perhaps that's changing with Startup Spokane and other organizations who are offering help to people who have ideas. The University of Washington has opened a satellite office of its CoMotion Labs at its Spokane Center. Elizabeth Scallon is CoMotion's Associate Director.
CoMotion Labs is a program that can help take early stage ideas and help you grow those through networks, through mentors, subject matter experts, through learning opportunities, sort of the fundamentals about startups. And then we also can introduce you to capital, to angels and to VCs in the area.
VCs stands for venture capitalists.
We've been here for a year and change. We spent a lot of time when we first got here making sure we understood how the ecosystem worked.
That's Brady Ryan, who manages CoMotion Labs in Spokane.
By the way, when we talk about an ecosystem, we're talking about everybody involved in making a city a good place to have a startup. So it's the startups themselves, it's the entrepreneurs that work on the startups, it's the funders and the investors that help keep the lights on. It is, and then it's the people we call kind of ecosystem players. So folks like us who have resources to help the startups.
CoMotion Labs looks at high-tech, high-growth startup potential areas. And so we have over 100 startups that are part of our program. They focus in on biomedical, robotics, engineering, all the buzzwords such as blockchain, artificial intelligence, augmented reality, virtual reality, software. So we do have that nice portfolio of emerging tech that we're engaged with.
Here in Spokane, there's about a dozen that we're working with and engaging with every day. And a lot of them they're very interesting. We have one company we work with that's helping improve sleep. And it seems simple, but they have a multi-pronged approach that helps understand how you're sleeping, helps you get the help you need better and cheaper than you otherwise could, and has really big impacts down the road for health and wellness and productivity.
CoMotion offers workshops that are open to the public.
Hey guys, we're about to get started. I just want to give a quick chance to do kind of round. Everyone just introduces themselves real quick. More people will file in, I'm sure, but at least.
Here, a dozen or so people are at the UW's downtown Spokane Center, munching on pizza and waiting for a live YouTube presentation from Seattle by Susan Preston from the Seattle Angel Fund and Sea Change Fund.
What we're talking about today is the challenge of doing a very effective pitch to investors. This is not the easiest thing to do, and it is something that you need to spend a lot of time working on. How do you approach investors? What do they think? How do you get your message across in an effective manner?
My name is Tim Krause with App2Market, and we help entrepreneurs and college students produce apps of their minimum viable product at a very reasonable price and very quickly so they can test the market with a real product.
Tim Krause was one of the people here to listen to Susan Preston. Soon he'll do his own presentation for CoMotion. He's impressed by the energy that's building around entrepreneurism in Spokane and happy to have a growing infrastructure for newcomers.
I like what CoMotion's doing. What they're trying to do is create opportunities to learn and grow that are outside of the university experience. So anybody in Spokane can come. And I talked to Brady and said, yeah, let's do something on app building because, you know, this is an area that's very hot right now. It's going to continue to grow. Everybody's got an idea for an app, but hey, let's put it in practice, right? Let's get it on paper. Let's see how well this can go.
Brady Ryan says he's impressed by the collaboration among entrepreneurs in Spokane. He says the environment for startups is beginning to permeate not just Spokane, but other parts of the Inland Northwest as well.
Between Tri-Cities, Wenatchee, Coeur d'Alene, you know, there are a lot of really interesting places here within a few hours drive, and there's no reason we shouldn't all be working together.
Brady Ryan is the manager of the University of Washington's CoMotion Labs in Spokane. Washington State University sleep researchers are keeping plenty busy this summer. 3 weeks ago, we told you about a new study into whether nurses working 12-hour shifts, especially overnight, become too fatigued to safely do their jobs. And now Professor Hans van Dongen is leading a team that has received a new Defense Department grant, $2.8 million, to study this question.
Why is it that people make, when they're sleep deprived, make bad decisions, but not all the time? So what is it about some decisions that go wrong when people are fatigued and other decisions that are not problematic? Why is it that people can, for most of us, can do most of our work just fine when we're fatigued? And we still show up for work every day, and we still, for the larger part, do our work just fine. But occasionally we make a really big mistake in our decision making that has far-reaching implications, and it sort of comes out of nowhere. And for a long time, we didn't quite understand what it was about, those sorts of mistakes that we make in decision-making or otherwise, that's at the heart of that problem. So we didn't really know what in the brain actually goes wrong.
When we're doing a task while we're tired, sometimes we've done it so often that it's routine and we just rely on experience and muscle memory and get it done, even though we might feel brain dead. Here's an example.
If you're at a door and it says pull and you push and it won't open, and you might notice that if you're sleep deprived, you keep pushing it until at some point you just give up and like, okay, I'll find another door. Whereas all you really needed to do is pull that door, right? Now you have to change your perspective. And what really happens in the brain then is the brain needs to switch from what we call proactive attentional control, knowing exactly what you want to do, to reactive attentional control, taking a step back, reevaluating the situation, taking in new information, making a new plan, and switching to another alternative strategy to get your work done. Right? And we've shown in the past that the effects of sleep deprivation on the brain are particularly strong when it has to deal with that switching from proactive to reactive attentional control.
So they're studying what happens in the brain when those switches are happening. A technical term for that is cognitive flexibility. Van Dongen wants to know why some people can make those switches without it affecting their performance while others can't. What happens differently in their brains? Some people, when they're pooped, load up on caffeine to keep them awake and alert.
Okay, so with caffeine, I can increase my alertness, but maybe or maybe not so much that cognitive flexibility problem. And there's some evidence to say that caffeine is maybe not super great at that, even though it keeps us awake enough to maybe make it home safely for the drive home. But we could still make a really bad financial decision or something like that and ruin our life some other way, right? There are other drugs like caffeine that impact on the brain in some other fashion and impact on that dopaminergic system, but also can keep us awake. And so now the question is, if you switch out caffeine for some other drug, do you then subsequently see that maybe that's not so great for the drive home, but it's actually much better for my decision making? If that turns out to be true, can we then subsequently design a drug that will give us all we need?
Van Dongen and his colleagues will recruit 90 people to contrast how their brains make that switch when they're tired versus when they're fully rested. The participants will spend a few days in the sleep lab on the WSU Spokane campus. The first night, they'll get a chance to fully rest. The next day, they'll do a series of activities. The next night, they'll be kept awake and then do the same set of activities the following day. The two performances will be contrasted. They'll also do the same protocol on mice or rats.
What we can do with rats is that they give us the ability to look much more precisely inside what's going on in the brain. And we don't actually necessarily have to go into the brain literally. One of the new advances that has come across recently is the use of optogenetics, which is basically the use of laser light to activate particular genes. And using this technology, we can start to stimulate neurons in a brain of a rat or a mouse to activate pieces of the brain that we want to see what happens when these pieces of the brain are activated.
Van Dongen says that process does not harm the animals, but it helps researchers pinpoint where there are brain activities. He says rat brains and human brains are similar enough in this regard that there's value to experimenting on both. The new grant covers a 3-year period. If all goes well, Van Dongen says researchers could wind up somewhere down the line working with WSU's College of Pharmacy to design a drug that would help people who are fatigued to make better decisions. This is Spokane Symphony double bass player Patrick McNally playing his instrument in his living room. We've come to McNally's home north of Spokane to learn about his recovery from a stroke. This is National Stroke Awareness Month. McNally's a young man. He's 38, married with 3 kids, including one born last year. He's played with the Spokane Symphony for about 11 years, and he remembers the day he felt his stroke symptoms.
Yeah, so it was September 5th, the day after Labor Day. We had just played the Labor Day concert in Comstock, and the next morning I woke up to bring my son to school that next morning. I got out of the shower, and half of my body was numb from my legs to my head, and I felt that was very odd. I sat down and Googled the symptoms on my iPhone, and it said I should probably call 911. And my wife called 911, and the firefighters were there probably within 5 minutes. Went from there. I was in the hospital within an hour, probably.
Did you ever lose consciousness or anything like that?
I did eventually in the hospital because I had a bad reaction to a drug, but no, not as a result of the stroke.
And was it a pretty obvious case that it was a stroke?
It wasn't actually that obvious because a lot of people have drooping face, so they have the FAST, the face, arm, speech, and time to call 911. I started getting weakness in my arm. That's probably the one that I had. My speech was fine. My face was not drooping. I was getting weak on the side that I had the numbness.
And was the morning that you woke up the first that you recognized those symptoms, or had you seen them before?
No, I'd never seen them before. Yeah, and it was not until I got right out of the shower that I had noticed it, and I thought it was, you know, just very, very strange. At one point, I could not lift my left leg or my left arm more than a couple inches off the bed of the hospital bed. So at that point, I was really worried about mobility and being able to just walk and things like that, because I couldn't walk. But as I started getting feeling back and everything, I lost feeling in the arms and the legs and the strength. So as that started slowly coming back, I definitely thought about, you know, my long-term, you know, bass playing and whether that would be able to continue that career, really.
I assume you finger with your left hand.
Correct.
Yeah. So, as you went back to the bass, was there any residual effect of the ability to finger?
I feel like I lost most of my muscles, and I sort of had to retrain my muscles in my arms. Now, I didn't lose anything in my brain, so I knew what my muscles should be doing, and I was trying to tell them that, and it just took a little rewiring, I think, to get that back up. And calluses, too. That was also an issue. I had to get my calluses back in.
Do your doctors have any idea about what the origin of your stroke?
Yeah, so I had something called a vertebral arterial dissection. So the arteries in the back of my spine going up my neck dissected. We're not entirely sure what caused that. And that caused the clot, which went into the brain.
Was there any doubt about whether you'd get through that?
I believe it is a very bad situation to be in, yes. Yes. Who knows what could have happened had I not gone into as quickly as I could to the hospital, because as the clot is sitting there in the brain's dying around that area, and I got a clot-busting drug, TPA, and that immediately got rid of the clot. And so, who knows how worse it could have been.
The doctors say that this is something that could happen again, or is this a once-in-a-lifetime sort of thing?
I think it is. I've been told that the likelihood of it happening is fairly small, the same amount that it was beforehand. So the likelihood of recurrence is pretty low, I think. I've been asked probably to avoid things that will jerk my neck, like roller coasters and cliff diving, which I had never done anyway, so it's probably okay.
So in terms of rehabilitating yourself to be able to play your instrument at the level that you played before, how long did it take to get that back?
I'm still working on that. And, you know, even at the height of my abilities, I always want to get better, right? But now I'm trying to focus on just certain aspects of, I'm getting a little bit of resistance from the muscles still, and I'm trying to figure out ways to get around it, and sometimes it's really just small movements of the muscle I took for granted beforehand, because it doesn't always come naturally right now, and so it's a little more work.
With McNally's youth, a stroke was not something he'd expected he'd have to deal with at this point in his life.
I'm hoping that my story will resonate to younger people too, because it is happening to younger people. And the sooner you can get to the hospital, assuming that it's a clot, the better off you are, or hemorrhage, whatever it is, the symptoms. If you see the symptoms of stroke, you need to get to the hospital as soon as possible.
It's Patrick McNally, who is a double bass player for the Spokane Symphony. You can learn more about strokes at the American Stroke Association website, strokeassociation.org. That's the May 24th edition of Inland Journal, Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can download a podcast to the program or listen online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Direct your comments to InlandJournal@KPBX.org or call our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. Spokane Public Radio is listener-supported and made possible through your contributions. Thank you for your support. I'm Doug Nadvornik.